evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop with the Blue Plate Special. And on the menu tonight, we have John Gilstrap. John is not only a good friend of mine, but he's the New York Times best-selling author of the Jonathan Graves Thriller Series and other fiction and nonfiction, including the first-rate 6 Minutes to Freedom, which will hopefully be a film before we know it. He's won awards for Best Paperback Original from the International Thrillers Association, and his books have been translated into 20 languages. He's also an explosive and safety expert and former firefighter. And he holds a master's degree from the University of Southern California and a bachelor's degree from the College of William and Mary in Virginia. And these days he lives in Fairfax. You can check him out at johngilstrap.com. Hey, my friend, how you doing tonight?
I couldn't be better. How are you?
Fine. See, we were just talking about the technical stuff, and my little musical intro decided it wanted to play twice there on me. Keeps it exciting. I love your new book, Final Target.
Thank you.
I just want to tell you, I think it's fantastic and a worthy addition to the Jonathan Graves universe. A question: where did Jonathan Graves come from? What was your basis for creating that character?
Well, back in 2006, I published a book came out called 6 Minutes to Freedom, which is a nonfiction book that took me 4 years to write. That features a Delta Force mission in Panama that was enormously successful and rescued Kurt Muse, who was a political prisoner. And the research that I did for this took me actually it was at that time the only book that Delta Force, the first Special Forces Operation Detachment Delta, had ever participated in. And, you know, I got to visit the compound. I talked to these guys. They're great guys. And introduced me to this new community. And I realized that people talk about Delta and they run those operations, you know, the other authors that take care of that sort of thing. But, you know, there's a fundamental difference between the way a hostage rescue is handled overseas and the way it's handled domestically. Domestically, because of, you know, Constitution and, you know, all that stuff that's very important.
All that pesky stuff, yes.
All that pesky stuff. When the hostage rescue team, FBI hostage rescue team, enormously talented folks, I know a number of them, you know, their careers are more in jeopardy when the bad guy gets away through the courts than they are if the good guy dies in the rescue. So
Whoa. It's
as opposed to when it's overseas, when somebody is taken hostage, the entire mission is to get the hostage back, and then gathering intel and all that other stuff is secondary. But the first mission is to get the good guy away from the bad guys. So I thought, wouldn't it be really cool to take a former Delta operator, aka Jonathan Graves, and take that work ethic, that ethos, and apply it domestically? Now, of course, the downside of that is that, you know, all the jurisdictions where he plies his trade have a lot of unsolved homicides that he leaves behind because he's killed people. So anyway, so that's where Jonathan Graves comes from.
It's a great character, and your research really does show through. What is your typical research for a Jonathan Graves novel?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm in my 11th. I think I'm right now writing my 11th book in the series. So a lot of the basic research is already done. So now what will happen is if I run into a particular tactic that I need, I delve into my virtual Rolodex and I call a buddy and I say, so how do you do this? I mean, that's the benefit of doing this for a long time and doing it successfully and being accurate. In fact, I think it was probably 6 weeks ago, I spent a day in Quantico, Virginia, playing with the hostage rescue team and blew doors. And I didn't blow it, but, you know, it was fast roping and the big show and behind the scenes tour. These guys, they're wonderful to work with. They're great fans of the books and they answer my phone call. So that's very important to me.
And I think that they appreciate having some accuracy portrayed about them and what they do in your books, correct?
Well, I like to think so. You know, I have found when I first was introduced to this community, what I knew about Delta and Navy SEALs and hostage rescue, they're all kind of cut from the same cloth. And boy, would they be upset if they heard me say that. But but you know, they are they're fundamentally good people who are focused on the mission. They are gentlemen and gentlemen who are capable of this unspeakable violence, and all for the forces of good. And I think that what I've done through Jonathan Grave is I've given some voice to that. Jonathan is, and his team, are capable of great violence, but at the end of the day, they're really good folks.
And I think I've read that before about those elite forces, is that it's about the code of honor and the code of conduct that is theirs. That mm-hmm. doesn't, it's very, very specific, very, very specific to them. And it's about, it's what they will not deviate from no matter what. Am I correct at all
yes.
in that?
Oh, no, you're very correct.
And that's what,
it's really all about, it's about comradeship and mission.
And that's it, the mission. It's all about the mission. You're, as you've said, your books have a lot of action and a lot of violence in them, but mostly it's the action. How do you approach trying to bring that to life? I'm thinking in particular your book where they go after the militia camp and there's mm-hmm. the big run and gun in the camp. That is thrilling to read. And very, very much page turning. How do you do that big multi-scene battle like that when you're writing it?
Well, frankly, those are exhausting. They take forever to write. I think people who don't write, I think, believe that the action scenes just kind of fly out. And the reality is that is the hardest writing for me that there is, because there's so much choreography that goes on between all the different parties. You've got good guys shooting at bad guys, and you got bad guys who think they're good guys that are shooting at who they think are the bad guys, right? I mean, here you're being invaded. And to get all that choreography to work is, it just is excruciating. And I do it by, you know, just kind of plowing through it, you know? It's a very mechanical process for me that, in my mind, I have a very... I know what this place looks like, so then it's a matter of getting the tactics to work out while describing a place that will resonate with the reader, right? I mean, there's a lot of moving parts to those things.
Yes, and if I recall, in that particular battle scene, you also had a good guy who was acting like a bad guy.
I had a good guy, good girl, actually, who
yes,
has turned
girl.
Out to be a psycho. Yeah, I mean, she's part of Jonathan's team who really enjoyed the killing.
And that was that dynamic was very interesting, too, because when you're on the ground with her, yeah, you kind of appreciate the fact that that bad guy is no longer shooting at you, but you're also appalled by the action that your team member just took, because there's,
yes.
this has rules.
Well, and Jonathan's code of conduct has always been, the order of battle has always been that he's not an assassin. If you don't pose a threat, you are not harmed. And in this case, Jelaine Cage was the name of the character in that book, and she was just taking pleasure in spray and slay, just killing all kinds of folks. And her coworkers, in this case, team members who needed her, were appalled. It was just kind of an interesting layer to throw in.
You always, every one of your books, I find you have a scene or two in it that just absolutely stick and resonate with me. Like there's the shooting on the bridge, the bridge in D.C. in one book, or in the one we were just talking about, the man trap, the booby trap that's in the store. Those
mm-hmm.
are always just those scenes always stick with me, because that's how well you handle them, even if they're
Thank
not.
You.
Integral to the plot. I mean, they move the plot forward, but the plot doesn't necessarily turn on them. They're just like, wow, that was awesome.
Well, thank
and that
you.
Shows your fascination with things that go bang and boom.
A little bit.
Um, That's my next question on is, you know, everybody who writes any sort of thriller, whether it's anything from a police procedural up through a military thriller, likes to make things explode in their books. You know, it's just kind of necessary. What do they do wrong? What are a lot of the error as an expert in munitions and explosives? What are some of the mistakes that you see?
Oh my goodness.
Give me a little best hits list.
You know, it's little bombs make little booms, big bombs make big booms. So, and if you go to, particularly in film, you know, the guy throws the hand grenade and brings down the building. No. Or you have the big battle sequence where the bombers are dropping 500,000-pound bombs and they make these little smoke pot booms and three people fall down. You know, it's the violence of explosives is really hard to comprehend, and it's almost impossible to portray on a film because actors do not want to be dismembered. I think it's in their contract that you're not allowed to dismember them. But, you know, the reality of an explosion, you set off a C4, TNT, you know, any of the detonable explosives, you're talking about a peak overpressure at the surface of, you know, if you're standing at the bomb, it goes from 14.7 PSI, which is what atmospheric pressure is, to a million plus PSI in a microsecond, and then it goes down to like 7 PSI on the rarefaction wave. It leaves nothing. And so that's what I have a problem with, is that most people don't understand how violent explosives and, frankly, gunshots are, and they're underplayed.
So with explosives, it's primarily getting the scale correct of what it is the size of the bomb you've made versus the destruction that you're trying to wreak in your in your story.
And in firearms, where the guy gets shot and gets blasted across the room, third law of motion. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So if the guy that's getting hit is being blown through that wall, then the guy with the gun needs to be blown through the opposite wall, right? So
yes.
It's that
and
sort
in
of
one
of, nerddom.
And in one of your seminars, you illustrated that well with the miracle of YouTube. Is there anything in the world that has not been YouTubed? Is you showed us basically someone getting shot, and the kind of shoot, the type of shot that doesn't, like, you know, take their head off, just basically a body shot, and the guy just crumples over on his side.
Yeah.
And that one, kind of, again, that you don't see or hear enough of that. Like you said, they're always being blown across the room. And
the reality of it is, when somebody gets shot to death, I mean, they shot in the head, or, you know, if they die instantly, think of a marionette whose strings are cut. You know, it's just down right away. That's as dramatic. It is very dramatic, but it's not physically dramatic.
On YouTube, that just reminded me, when I was interviewing Mark Graney one night, I was talking about a scene in one of his books where you get to find out what happens when you throw a handful of live ammo in a deep fryer.
Okay. Why not?
And I asked him, you know, basically, how did you research that? And he's like, oh, YouTube, trust me. Evidently, someone had done that.
Okay.
And it's impressive.
I got to tell you, it sounds kind of intriguing. You know what I'm doing when we hang up, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Have you ever read any of Mark's Gray Man series?
Oh, I have. I think Mark's brilliant.
Yes, it's in one of his Gray Man books. I think it's in Backblast, the deep fryer scene. It was not the newest one, but I think the one right before it. And I think actually, man, talk about every once in a while they'll do these anthologies of crossovers and stuff like that. I think we need Jonathan. I think we need Jonathan Graves teaming up with Court Gentry. I think
that could
be
kind of cool.
I think that'd
be
some mayhem
cool
right there.
But Mark already writes what, 4 or 5 books a year? I mean, he's a beast. He's a machine.
It's insane. I particularly enjoyed too. Just one more minute on that is I thought he really did justice to the Tom Clancy legend as well with the Jack Ryan Jr. books.
I agree.
I thoroughly enjoyed those, and man, no one was more skeptical than I was. And I ended
up. Hey, Grady,
up just
you owe me. I'm pitching your books on the radio show. You owe me.
So am I. I've already made him promise that he has to come back when the new Court Gentry comes out, because he started a new story arc, and I want to see where Court's headed on that one. So really, it's the research and the knowledge that you have, and backing it up with a lot of YouTube?
Well, I think Jonathan's never shot a gun that I have not shot. It's research and going on a good imagination. You know, I think people, mm-hmm. Research is great until you realize you're just kind of in the sleeve of, I get this. And then, mm-hmm. to be able to represent the technical detail without boring the reader with the technical detail, it'd be being able to pull back. That's it's fun to do. It's hard to do, and it's good for 11 books so far.
Most definitely good for 11 books so far. And I get that too. I remember once I needed a question answered about cell phones and towers. A friend of mine, her husband's an expert in that, a technician. And I asked her my question, and I got the big long answer about how cell phone towers work and the technology. And I'm like, okay, so it's reasonable that she'd have 2 bars at this point. And it's like, well, yeah. It's like, good, that's what I needed to know. Yeah, because I go trying to go for that authenticity of, it's like she needs to make 1 phone call and they're out in the middle of nowhere. And so I got the information I needed about cell towers to be able to say that, yeah, okay, it's reasonable that she could make that phone call out in the middle of the desert like that. And I've heard that before too, that something like good research makes a 600-page book into a 500-page book.
Not heard that, but it makes sense.
That was I picked that up at a seminar once. They said it's because then you get the confidence to just be able to pick the little bits and pieces out. And if you speak authoritatively, the reader will kind of go, okay, you know what you're doing. And they'll roll with you on the rest of it. Like, I fully believe that Digger and Boxers know how to use every one of the weapons that you put in their hands.
Well, that's good. And they do. They're very good with them.
And you don't have to, unless it moves the plot forward, you don't have to go into how you have to flick this lever up to get the magazine to drop out of it and, you know, that routine, because you just assume that they know how they're doing it because you've presented it authoritatively.
Well, you know, it's finding I was just talking about this at a seminar I taught last weekend at the Smithsonian, and the question came up about how do you handle the technical detail versus boring the reader. And the mix for me is a single mention, you know, that Jonathan is using a Heckler & Koch 416 chambered in 5.56 millimeter, and you mention it one time. And then from then on, it's the HK416 or the M27, as the case may be. But it's you put it out there for the folks for whom that detail is important, and then you move on for the vast majority of people to whom the detail is not important.
It's a big gun
at that
point. Or a small gun, depending on if you need it to be a small one.
A BFG.
Yeah, exactly. And I found too, like I was picking out a pistol for one of my characters to carry, and I kept going, I just researched it, and I kept finding blog after blog after blog where they were talking about something about the trigger needing adjusting, that once you got the trigger adjusted correctly, that it was a great pistol. So in the book, I had the character say, once I got the trigger adjusted, I can take you at range every time. Just that, throwing in those little details that you find in the places where people talk about firearms. You mentioned teaching at the Smithsonian. Tell me about that.
I teach a course called Adrenaline Rush Writing Suspense Fiction. It's an all-day course, about 6 hours, I guess. And I taught at Midwest Writers Workshop a couple of weeks ago before that. And the Smithsonian happens to be a venue. I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and they sponsor, actually across the hall while I was teaching this, there was a seminar on Renaissance art. Fortunately, no one got confused and were in the wrong class. So,
now we have big guns in Renaissance art. Cool.
Exactly. So when did Michelangelo get the, but that is not it. That's a craft class, not a technical class. But the idea is to help new writers, fledgling writers, whatever is the right phrase, understand the basics of how to create suspense and how to create compelling characters who are in jeopardy. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it. Why are all these things so far away? None of you know how to spell Kansas City correctly. Because
well,
that's where they
Kansas
need
Kansas City
of these
were to call me, I'd be there.
I need to work on that. I definitely need to work on that. Because to anyone who's listening, I've been in several of John's classes, and I was actually one of those, and the word you were looking for was clueless writer. and got to learn a few things about, 27 pages of backstory in your first chapter and that sort of thing. One of your it was fun. No, it was fun, and I still have the letter. I still have the notes you gave me with the words "this sucks" on it prominently. You were right.
It
you
was
were
delivered.
Absolutely...
I would not have said that if I didn't have faith in you as a writer. I would not. If I thought you were talentless, I wouldn't say it sucks. But let's be honest.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, and that I still had that, I was so green, I squeaked when I walked type of thing on it. And no, that made me better. I didn't need to be candied along and told how precious I was at that point. I needed to be told that what I had written here had promise but was not good in its present form. And that's one thing I say too, because I'm reaching a little bit of a level, is there's an old saying that says, always play tennis with somebody who can beat you.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you do is you find that you're moving up the ranks, and it's taking a lot more skilled players to beat you as you move up the ranks. And you're also finding on the other side that people want to play tennis with you because you beat them.
Well, I always believe that you hang with what you aspire to be.
Yes.
Whether it's in a conference or whatever.
And that's always what I do. One thing I've been finding out when I've been talking to writers is, that was my first BoucherCon at Raleigh, is there were basically about 10 cons going on at the same time in different places. Because people keep telling me stories about Raleigh that I had no clue about because I wasn't there. I was in the other corner, probably arguing with you and Revis over guns. Are you going to Toronto this year?
I'm not. I'm not going to make BoucherCon this year. I'll be there. Where is it? Florida next year, I think.
I'll be in Florida with bells on, and we'll probably be broadcasting from there.
Oh, cool.
Because that's authors on the air territory, and also the territory of my sponsor, Down and Out Books, which is just turning out some amazing crime fiction. They have really stepped up. They picked up 6 Anthony nominations this year.
Wow,
that's not too shabby for
not
a small
bit.
Press right there. So I'm really really looking forward to BoucherCon. So moving on a little bit, you recently announced that you were included in an anthology. What's that all about?
I should be able to pull up what the name of the anthology is. Jonathan Mayberry is the editor, and it's essentially about private investigators who deal with the occult. That's what it had to be. It was the mashup between occult and PI mysteries. And the story I did was so out of my wheelhouse, and I had so much fun. My story is called Sully's Gift, and it's about a PI named Norman Sullivan who happens to be able to talk to dead people. And the dead people can do research for him because they can witness things because they're dead, and they can go into, you know, we got bad guys that are meeting. They can go and actually witness what's there. They're as ghosts. They're invisible, and then they can report back. And, of course, there's a downside to that when the retribution comes. So that was – I started writing this story not really knowing where I was going to go, and 10,000 words later, I had this sort of longest short story called Sully's Gift. It was great fun, really a good time. And Jonathan is an old friend of mine. We've known each other for years.
He's going to be on the show next week, and I can just barely wait to talk to him. That is just going
to
be...
Oh, tell him I said hi.
Oh, definitely. And if you're around, feel free to call in for sure.
All right.
Because that's, you know, he is just turning out, editing these amazing anthologies. It seems like there's an announcement every week of another, you know, another really, really cool anthology. Sherlock Holmes, X-Files. Psychic detectives.
Yeah, I did the I had a story in his X-Files anthology too. That was fun.
Oh, cool. What was that about?
X-Files. Mulder ends up finding a portal that goes back in time, and it's a murder mystery where the murderer has gone to a different dimension and does not want to come back.
As one does. That sounds fascinating.
Would you want to come back? You know?
That's a loaded question right now. Also, I plan on talking with Jonathan about his relationship with the late George Romero, sort of thing. I mean, just the amazing body of work that Jonathan has put out. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. This has been a fun month with the show, where I've called it my Blitz month, and I've talked to everybody from, you know, cozy authors through science fiction, through dark crime, through very high octane thrillers like yours and Mark's. So it's been a great time. Starting in September, I'll be on Friday nights. And I decided to make it multi-genre because the network has shows that are noir and thriller and that type of thing. And it's like, I like everything. I like a little bit of everything. And I'm also friends with a lot of writers across different genres too. So it just seemed like that's where I came up with the Blue Plate Special. You just never know what's going to be on the menu. So when we were in the green room, you were talking about you're on Deadline right now.
Yeah. I owe a book on September 15th, actually on September 12th, because my wife has booked a trip for us that leaves on September 12th. So I can do it.
And is this a Jonathan Grave?
It is. It's the next called Scorpion Strike. And I know where it's going. I just have to make it go there.
Can you do a two sentence sneak peek?
Jonathan and his on-again, off-again girlfriend and fellow operator, Gail Bonneville, are on a sort of a relationship-mending trip to a resort in the Pacific, an island resort. And in Chapter 1, the island resort is invaded by terrorists who take all of the guests hostage. And Jonathan and he really objects to that. It does not end well for the hostages who come to take him, or for the hostage takers who come to take him hostage. And ultimately it comes to boxers, to his cohort, to assemble a team to come and rescue him. So Jonathan becomes the precious cargo.
Oh, that sounds great. I mean, your typical mayhem ensues with a little twist to it of Jonathan's working on the inside.
Right.
And like you said, suddenly he's the precious cargo. Where does that phrase come from, precious cargo? We hear it all the time in your books.
That's what the operators call of when Delta goes on a hostage rescue mission or whatever, it's the person to be plucked out is the precious cargo or the PC.
It's an interesting phrase. I always think too, and I'm sure the Delta guys are thinking once they've actually extracted the person, the emphasis is on cargo, which is moving and delivering them.
That's right. You know, they are not psychologists. They are moving and exactly right. They're pickup and delivery.
I think I got into an argument over that with someone about like high elected officials up to and including the president. They're like, you know, why doesn't the president do this? Why doesn't the president do that? And I said, you don't understand. At that level of the game, he's not a passenger. He's cargo.
Yeah, exactly.
Their job is to deliver him so they can go home. And they're gonna and the people who are doing that.
I presume we're talking about the Secret Service point of view at this point, right?
Secret Service, the Marines, military, everybody who is involved in moving a president, they just want to get him delivered.
Exactly.
And I think that's your guys too. The sooner the PC is dropped in the arms of whoever gave the order, they want to go home and have a beer, correct?
A scotch, actually, but yes.
Scotch. Okay. I can see that. I can definitely see that. Do you have anything else? Anything else going on? Are you in any like short story writing or anything else?
Not at this point. I am sort of just flat out going to finish this book, and then we're going to go away for a couple of weeks on vacation, and then you know the conference schedule starts. October is lost to Magna Cum Murder and to, you know, some of the other conferences that I'm going to. And then there's the holidays, and then there's the SHOT Show in January. And so, and then all the edits and stuff that I have to do on Scorpion Strike when it comes back. So this is kind of my job for the next few months.
What conferences are you going to be at?
I'm going to one, it's called Creatures, Crimes, and Creativity, C3. Which will be in September, early-ish September. It's a local one. It's kind of an interesting conference. It's cross-genre. And actually, Jonathan Mayberry, I think, is the guest of honor. And Jeffrey Deaver will be there. And my editor, Michael Hamilton, has a presentation she'll be doing. And it's kind of like Old Home Week. And I like the fact that it's nearby. So
excellent.
I have to travel all the way to Baltimore. And after that, there's Magna. I'm missing something in between. I forget what it is. But I'm kind of cutting back some on the conference schedule. I'm not going to BoucherCon for a number of reasons. I think it's a great conference, but just not this time around.
I've heard that a lot. Is it just that BoucherCon just isn't convenient for a lot of people this year, and that's sad. Still going to be a hell of a party.
It will be a hell of a party, and it's interesting because, you know, BoucherCon, as great a party as it is primarily a mystery conference, and I didn't realize until ITW, International Thriller Writers, came into being how big a difference there is between mysteries and thrillers in terms of the fan base and just all the, from the writer's point of view, all those moving parts are entirely different or substantively different between mysteries and thrillers. And BoucherCon is very mystery-focused. That's not a bad thing.
No.
But it's just what it is. So Thriller Fest, to me, is the one that I can never miss because that's sort of the industry conference. And Magna Cum Murder is sponsored by Ball State University in Indiana. That's like going to Thanksgiving dinner. It's just meeting up with old friends. It is, hands down, the best, friendliest, most fun conference that there is.
I need to check out Magna because Indianapolis is not that far away from me. It's totally doable. So I definitely need to check that one out. Thriller Fest is like on my list. You know, that'll be the the one that I really, really want to go to. I'm hoping for next year. But, yeah, next year, BoucherCon for sure in Florida. I don't think Pam Stack, I think she'd come and get you if you weren't there. I think she'd just be driving around with a van, picking up all the writers, you know, writers. It's like, why aren't you in Florida, you know, within
right.
her within her reach. So I just can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on tonight. This was great.
Oh, you know, ask and I shall be there. We've known each other a long time. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, for sure, when the new book comes out. I'll be keeping an eye out for it, and we'll definitely have you on there to talk about it. Because I want to, now that one fascinates me, because you're taking the whole, you're not turning it completely on its head, but you're definitely turning the lever a half a turn over. And
no,
I'll be
Jonathan
interested.
A girlfriend.
Well, yeah, that's one of the questions I was going to ask you. It's like, is that guy ever going to go out on a date? I mean, he's handsome, he's wealthy. I have made the joke more than one time that he lives in Stately Wayne Manor.
It's a firehouse.
This guy. But it has the underground. I mean, it has a bat cave, for heaven's sakes. Exactly.
Actually, every
totally
book does have a gratuitous reference to Batman in one way or the
absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely.
I mean, the car that he
absolutely.
Drives, he calls the Batmobile. So.
Yeah, that's it. He's a totally cool Bruce Wayne, and he totally needs to have a girlfriend. So yes, you're giving, like I said, you're taking the whole Digger Graves mythology and you're giving it a nice twist, and that's going to be very interesting. So, I have a couple of housekeeping type announcements I have to make here, and so I will tell you good night, and that I look forward to talking to you more, and I hope to run into you at a conference this year.
All right, we'll see you soon. Take care.
Okay. This broadcast, it's made possible by the sponsorship of Down and Out Books. They're celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction, 6 years of publication, 6 Anthony nominations. I don't think that's a coincidence. And I believe they're just getting started. You can check them out at www.downandoutbooks.com. Cast is also owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Radio Network, LLC. You can follow the Blue Plate Special on Facebook to keep up with who is on the menu for future broadcasts. Right now, I want to tell everybody good night, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.